It's a pleasure to welcome everybody here on this somewhat damp morning. This is the last in the sequence of four specialist tax seminars which the List has conducted. The format for this morning is that the topic which is centred on the Federal Court or the conduct of litigation in the Federal Court will be introduced by Stephen Linden, and it will be followed by a panel discussion in which, of course, Stephen will join, and Ian Stewart, Melanie Baker, and Michael Berman will participate. Now, as I said, the presentation will be by Stephen Linden. He's a specialist in taxation law and dispute resolution involving tax matters. He has a Master of Laws from Melbourne University with a special focus on tax law. He's practiced for many years as part of the tax team in the Office of the Australian Government Solicitor before moving to the Legal Services branch of the ATO, and then in 2009 he came to the bar. So if I, without further introduction, if I could ask Stephen to present his paper.
Thank you, Don. I'm going to talk about three general topics this morning. Preparation and planning for tax litigation, the Federal Court tax practice note, and thirdly, discharging the burden of proof. Hopefully that will set the scene for the panel discussion that follows. Preparation and planning, it's important for both parties to prepare and plan their case as early as possible. That will assist in at least three ways. Firstly, in the choice of forum between the tribunal and the court. Secondly, in preparing appeal statements required at the beginning of litigation in the Federal Court. And thirdly, in preparation and guidance for the scheduling conference, which happens fairly early on in the proceedings. So, in terms of preparation and planning, from the taxpayer's perspective, they should, as soon as the objection decision is received, identify the issues for appeal or review. Each issue needs to be identified and consider how, in terms of factual issues, how each issue will be proved. What evidence is available, what needs to be obtained, and who are the potential witnesses. And in terms of questions of issues of law, what the principal authorities are. So then you come to the choice of forum, and I wanted to mention a few factors in relation to the choice of forum. In relation to if there is an opinion or discretion of the commissioner involved in the liability, there's a difference between how the Federal Court deals with it and how the tribunal deals with it. Where the formation of opinion of the commissioner is a criterion of liability, the process of reaching that opinion or exercising discretion is reviewable under the principles in Avon Downs. So basically reviewable for mistakes of law, whereas in the tribunal will stand in the shoes of the commissioner and form its own opinion or exercise its own discretion. So that's a factor to take into account. Costs, of course, there's a difference there. Costs will generally follow the event in the court, but the tribunal's cost-free jurisdiction. And another factor to take into account are the appeal rights from a decision that goes against you. From the court, there's a right of appeal to the full court, but from the AAT, the right of appeal is limited to a right of question of law, and the question of law is a jurisdictional requirement, so the appeal, the competency of the appeal will depend on a question of law arising, and in the notice of appeal it's necessary to state precise question or questions of law. Order 33, Rule 13 requires that, and that reflects its full course decision in Birdseye and ASIC. So, in relation to timing, both the Federal Court and the AAT, the taxpayer has 60 days to file their application or appeal from the service of the objection decision. So, moving then to the Federal Court practice note. First item there is appeal statements. Commissioner has 28 days after service of the appeal to file and serve his appeal statement. It's under Order 33, Rule 3. And the applicant's appeal statement is due 12 days after the commissioner's. So the applicant won't have a great deal of time to formulate that, and so the early preparation I spoke about before is important. The appeal statement must contain the basic elements of the party's case, the relief sought where applicable, the issues the party believes are going to arise, the principal matters of fact upon which the party intends to rely, the party's contentions, including legal grounds and leading authorities. There's no set style that's generally set out in three parts: facts, issues and contentions. And it may be drawn in a pleading style, and it should be succinct but persuasive. An issue the panel might consider is how much detail should go into an appeal statement and what variations they have experienced. Now, second item is the scheduling conference. That's usually 6 or 7 weeks or 8 weeks after the appeal has been filed. Each party must bring an initial witness list to the conference. Very often the commissioner won't be relying on calling any witnesses, apart from perhaps expert witnesses if it's appropriate. Taxpayer, the applicant on the other hand, will generally need to call witnesses, and they should endeavour to formulate that list as close as possible to what the list will be at the final list will be, so that changes are minimised. The pre-trial schedule, the judge will establish a schedule for interlocutory steps, assisted by the parties, so it's important that the parties have considered what the appropriate steps are before the conference, and it's a good idea for the parties to have discussed it before the conference. interrogatories and particulars are not permitted. Any questions regarding particulars should be considered and dealt with, considered before the scheduling conference and dealt with at the scheduling conference. Discovery is limited. In terms of what discovery is permitted are set out in the practice note at paragraph 6.1. And generally orders are made for affidavits to be filed and served for the trial. One issue that might come up is whether there should be a split trial of specific issues. However, it would be unusual for the court to split the trial tax case. One example might be splitting the substantive tax and penalties issues. However, given that evidence on substantive tax may be relevant to the penalties, for example, whether the taxpayer's position was reasonably arguable, it may be generally that the issues are best heard together. Justice Logan recently considered an application to split an issue about whether an assessment was issued in time. His Honour referred to some observations that the saving of time advantages of split trials is often illusory. And in that case, he determined that there wouldn't be any saving of time involved with splitting the trial. However, it's not unprecedented. His Honour noted that it was done in the Darrell Lee case. Now, evidence. The general practice is to have affidavit evidence for the trial, and they must contain only admissible evidence. Hearsay should be avoided if possible. There's an exception for first-hand hearsay and representations in documentary form, where the person who made the representation is not available to give evidence, or would cause undue expense or undue delay or not reasonably practicable to call the person. Reasonable notice is required to rely on these exceptions. There is an exception for business records, where the representation is by a person who might reasonably be supposed to have had personal knowledge of the asserted fact. Statements of opinion should be avoided, apart from, of course, experts. And documents, the admissibility of document may be established by an affidavit of a person who had a position of responsibility in relation to making or keeping the document, and also the court may examine the document and draw any reasonable inferences from it. Another possible way of proving facts is to use a notice to admit facts or documents, but this would generally only be useful, I think, for non-contentious documents or facts. Expert evidence. An expert must have specialised knowledge based on the person's training, study or experience, and the opinion must be wholly or substantially based on that knowledge. And the requisite contents of an expert report are set out in Rule 23.13. They include an acknowledgement that the expert has read, understood and complied with the practice note for expert witnesses, particulars of the expert's training, study or experience, questions that the expert was asked to address, the factual findings or assumptions on which the expert opinion is based, and the expert's opinion separate from those factual findings or assumptions. The panel might want to consider their discuss their experience with where experts confer and report on any matters of agreement or difference, or alternatively their experience with hot tubbing of experts. The final topic I wanted to talk about is discharging the burden of proof in practice and some examples. The The burden of proof under section 14 ZZO is to establish that the assessment is excessive. The word excessive relates to the substantive liability in contrast to the procedure or mechanism of the assessment. So the first example I wanted to mention was the fault assessment. Section 166 of the 1936 Act provides the primary source of the Commissioner's duty to assess. Under that provision, the Commissioner must make an assessment of the taxable income and tax payable thereon from the returns and or any other information in his possession. Section 167 is to be read with 166. It sets out three situations in which the Commissioner may make an assessment upon which, in his judgment, income tax ought to be levied for the purposes of section 166. They are person defaults in lodging a return, or the Commissioner has the Commissioner is not satisfied with the return, or the Commissioner has reason to believe that a person who has not lodged a return has derived taxable income. So that person may not be in default but hasn't lodged a return, and the Commissioner can make an assessment in those circumstances if he believes that that person has derived taxable income. The Commissioner has considerable scope in exercising his judgment under section 167 as long as he makes a genuine attempt about what the amount should be. Examples of approaches he's taken include an asset betterment analysis, for example in George's case, and a receipts basis, for example in the Marijancevic case. In that case, deposits into a bank account form part of the income assessed by the Commissioner. Taxpayer will generally not be able to discharge the onus of proof by showing an error by the Commissioner in relation to exercising his judgment calculating an amount. The taxpayer will generally need to show that the assessment is excessive and by how much it is excessive. Second example of discharging the burden of proof I wanted to raise is profit-making purpose in a transaction. For example, whether it's a profit-making scheme of a taxpayer. The court may have regard to the evidence of what the taxpayer had in mind and also to the surrounding facts and the events that occurred, and the latter type of evidence will generally be more cogent. In that regard, objective evidence is very important. The rare case that the taxpayer succeeded on oral evidence about subjective intention alone. However, if the objective circumstances support the taxpayer's case and give rise to a proper inference as to the taxpayer's purpose in entering the transaction, that will be sufficient to discharge the burden. Contemporaneous documents are often significant in relation to that. Third example I wanted to mention is whether an amended assessment is made without power under section 170. The Commissioner's authority to amend an assessment depends on whether he's within the time limit set out in section 170, and the taxpayer can challenge whether those conditions were satisfied when an amended assessment was made as a matter going to substantive liability. And the burdens on the taxpayer to prove that those conditions were not satisfied. In the case where an opinion of the Commissioner is challenged in the federal court, for example, that there's been fraud or evasion, it's necessary to establish an error of the kind described in Avon Downs. The fourth and final example of discharging the burden of proof I want to mention is in relation to penalties. A taxpayer may object against an assessment of shortfall penalty, and has review rights to the AAT or court. Issues that might arise include whether the taxpayer or its agent took reasonable care, was reckless, or intentionally disregarded a taxation law, or whether the taxpayer's position was reasonably arguable. They're all possible issues in relation to penalty. As with the primary liability, the onus is on the taxpayer to prove that the penalty is excessive, and the taxpayer can discharge that onus by proving that the necessary preconditions to the operation of the penalty provision did not exist. For example, establishing that the taxpayer and, if applicable, its agent exercised reasonable care, was not reckless, or did not intentionally disregard a taxation law, as the case may be. The Commission also has a general discretion to remit penalties. A taxpayer may object against a remission decision and has review rights in relation to that as well. In the court, again, it would be necessary to establish an error of the kind described in Avon Downs. That's all I wanted to say. Hopefully there are some issues there that panel might want to discuss, and any questions that arise can be covered in the panel discussion. Thank you.